We will proceed to our final case of the morning. It's number 083770, United States versus Skoin, I think is how it's pronounced. Mr. Lieberman, and before we begin, yes, I think the record should reflect that we have some very fine-looking lawyers' assistants on both sides with us here this morning. You're all very welcome.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Proceed.
And may it please the Court, my name is Michael Lieberman, and I do represent the appellant, Stephen Skoin, in this case. The issue in this case is whether the Supreme Court's decision in District of Columbia versus Heller in any way changes the analysis that this and other courts had previously used in deciding whether 18 United States Code Section 922G, specifically in this case 9, the possession of a firearm by a person previously convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence violates the Second Amendment, and obviously it's our position that it does. I acknowledge right up front that I am swimming upstream here. I know that a number of cases have addressed this since Heller was decided. This court, at least by my research, has not directly addressed this question. But I have
yet. You just want to give us a chance.
Every time, exactly right, Judge.
There are no appellate decisions on this statute, are there?
None that I could find. There are district court opinions, no appellate decisions that I could find.
So you are the first.
Apparently, yeah, I think so. The first question, Your Honor, that I think the court has to resolve is what is the level of scrutiny that the court is going to apply. The district court in this case did not decide that. It's our position that it should be strict scrutiny. And as I cited in our brief, pre-Heller, this court decided in Sklar versus Byrne that if the gun statute was found to be a fundamental right, then it would be the strict scrutiny standard. And it's my view that that is exactly what the Supreme Court found in Heller, that it is a fundamental personal right as opposed to a group right, which had been the understanding prior to Heller.
But the court expressly carved out statutes prohibiting possession of firearms by felons and possession of firearms by those who are mentally ill, and the statutes about school zones and other sensitive places and so forth. So it seems at least implicit in that language in the court's opinion that something less than strict scrutiny applies. Obviously something more than rational basis, they completely ruled that out. But it seems to me it might fall in the middle somewhere. And the challenge is to figure out which of the intermediate standards might apply.
And that might ultimately be, Your Honor, it's our view that, first of all, the language that Your Honor cites to, and this I understand this is a slightly different point than what you asked, has been relied on both by the government and the district court in this case and a bunch of other cases to stand for the proposition that the Supreme Court has already basically decided this question by the language that said that it's not intended to cast doubt on other longstanding prohibitions.
Well, this prohibition
is
not
longstanding. That's exactly right, and that's my point. So I don't believe that, first of all, the language is dicta. I understand that dictum from the Supreme Court is certainly treated differently than dicta from other courts, but it is not part of the necessary holding of the case. And as Your Honor pointed out, this is not a longstanding prohibition. So I believe that this issue is still open. Now, the fact that the Supreme Court said that other statutes would pass constitutional muster post-Heller, I respectfully disagree that that means that they're not applying strict scrutiny. Some statutes will survive a strict scrutiny analysis, and I would submit things like possessing a gun in a school zone, it's pretty obvious why that would be a compelling government interest and why possessing a firearm in that area would, or preventing possession of a firearm would be narrowly tailored. In this case, we have a gentleman who is a hunter, and the record below is undisputed, I believe, that his possession in this case, at least what he was charged with, now things changed a little bit at the time of sentencing, but at the time of the plea, everybody agreed that the only thing he was charged with was possessing a hunting rifle for hunting. He possessed it, and the facts that supported the possession were he had been hunting earlier that day, and he killed a deer that day, and when his probation officer came for the search, they found the deer hanging in his garage, and it was proved that he's the one that shot it. So the issue, I think, is does preventing a hunter who at some time in the past had a misdemeanor conviction for domestic violence from hunting, is that narrowly tailored or precisely tailored, as this court characterized it in Sklar, to serve a compelling government interest? And as I think I set out in my brief, it's our position that it is not.
Does your client win only if we use strict scrutiny? In other words, does he lose at the intermediate scrutiny level?
I certainly think we have a better chance of winning if the court applies strict scrutiny. I think even at an intermediate scrutiny level, it still has to be substantially related to an important government interest. And there's no doubt that the interest here is both important and compelling. Obviously, preventing people from getting shot is an important and compelling interest. So I think the court's focus really should be on whether the statute and how precisely or substantially tailored or related to achieving that interest it would be. There are other ways to achieve that same interest other than preventing the Steve Skoyans of the world from hunting. And I think that it's important for the court to focus on the facts of this case, which is this is a hunting case. This is not a person that was stockpiling weapons in the home. This isn't a person who collected guns. He borrowed a gun from his father to go hunting.
Well, what if it had been a handgun that he kept for protection? Would the analysis be any different?
I think that brings it a little bit closer to the precise issue in Heller, but I also think that raises the level of danger involved because then it is a handgun that he's keeping in the house.
Of course, he probably had a restriction in his probation as well, prohibiting him from having any firearms, didn't he?
Yes.
So it violated both the federal law and the conditions of his probation.
And his probation was violated on that basis, and he did serve a state revocation sentence for exactly that same conduct. That's correct.
One of the major issues here, as I see it, is that this is a perpetual ban. Once you're convicted of a misdemeanor, you are forever disabled from any gun ownership or gun possession. And while that calculus might survive when you're talking about felons, the reach of this is much broader because it's a perpetual ban against a misdemeanant. If this were a five-year ban, that's an easier case for the government, I assume.
I agree, Your Honor. And to take that one step further, based on this court's holding, which was ultimately affirmed by the Supreme Court in the Logan case, I think that points out exactly why this is a problem. And this isn't in the brief, so I apologize, but I think it's in response to Your Honor's question. The statutes do provide that a felon who then has his rights restored can now possess a weapon again. But the issue in Logan was, is a misdemeanant whose rights are never revoked, because under a misdemeanor conviction in state court, he's not prohibited from having a gun. And the issue in Logan is, if the rights are never revoked, can they legally be restored to make the exception under, I believe it's 920A30, apply? And what the Supreme Court said in Logan is, no, restored is different from never revoked. So a misdemeanant is in even a worse position, I would submit, than a felon, because a felon can at least petition to have his rights restored. A misdemeanant can't, because those rights were never taken away. And it's United States versus Logan is the case, and I'm sorry, I don't have the site. I see that my rebuttal light is on. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning. Tim O'Shea for the United States. I submit that the district court correctly denied Mr. Scoyne's motion to dismiss the indictment for two reasons. As Judge Crabb held, that Section 922G9 survives even the strict scrutiny test, as it's narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling government interest. And as the Booker court that held, the district court from Maine, he pointed out that persons that are prosecuted under 922G9 have already been convicted of a crime of violence against a spouse or current or former spouse, a child, or another intimate. And Judge Sykes mentioned, well, what about a felon? Well, you know, lots of felons who do nonviolent things are also have a ban on them that is a perpetual ban unless they get their rights restored, which is, I don't know what the stats are, but it's rather unlikely. So we have bad people that have committed bank fraud, tellers that have taken money out of the till, people have done other nonviolent things. All of them have the lifetime ban, and the Supreme Court suggested that would be appropriate to strip those folks of their Second Amendment rights. This court in Gillespie said that Congress could conclude that persons convicted of misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence pose the most acute danger of turning a gun on a family member. Mr. Scoyne's own history with his current wife and his ex-wife certainly suggests that he is a person who we'd reasonably consider dangerous. And the statistics bear it out as well, and I cite in the government's brief the statistics from the Bureau of Justice. You know, over 10% of the murder victims over the 30 years that are covered there were killed by an intimate. And over half those people, if you dig into the stats, were killed by someone who was armed with a firearm. So Congress acted more than reasonably. It is a narrowly crafted statute to protect people, and reducing domestic gun violence is a compelling government interest. Now, although Mr. Scoyne did possess his firearms, he had clearly hunting weapons and clearly self-protection weapons, the type of weapon that was in Heller. There's nothing about the fact that Mr. Scoyne is a hunter that gives him more rights than the average person. You know, although firearms are useful for hunting and have been since the time of the Constitution, firearms use in hunting is, of course, very strictly regulated. You know, hunters are told where to hunt, when to hunt, how to hunt, when they can use firearms, what type of firearm that can be used. The highly regulated nature of hunting in and of itself tells us that there's nothing special about hunters that give them extra rights over your average gun owner. And Mr. Scoyne, you know, my sons, we stopped on the way down at Cabela's, and they've got rows and rows of bows there. If Mr. Scoyne wants to hunt, he's not done hunting. He's just done with a gun. If there are no other questions, that's all for the United States.
Well,
This is an intermediate scrutiny?
Well, I don't know if it is or not. In the Supreme Court, as the court knows, Dodge did. The Booker case explored it quite a bit out of Maine. They think that the Supreme Court is sort of trending towards a strict scrutiny case. And I think even under strict scrutiny, the government wins in this case, Your Honor.
No, I know that's your position, but we do have to select a standard of review, and I'm not quite convinced that we're in strict scrutiny land based on the carve-out language in the Heller opinion.
Right. Well, we know it's not rational basis. The Heller court rejected that. In what flavor of intermediate, I simply don't know. On some level, although they rejected the interest balancing test, that's clearly what we have to do on some level. It is a right, an individual right. We know that from Heller. And we have to balance that against what we perceive to be the dangerousness. And clearly, you know, guns in the hands of people who've already, you know, been convicted of this type of crime against an intimate, you know, is a dangerous thing.
What about the argument that misdemeanants can't have their rights restored and therefore get their gun rights back because their rights are never taken away to begin with?
I do not know the law in the state of Wisconsin of whether one can have that type of conviction expunged if there's a process. I simply...
It's not an expungement question.
Or get it somehow wiped out at all. You know, I mean, clearly if a conviction is expunged, that'd be one way to get it back. But in terms of voting rights and that sort of thing, there clearly is a separate track for people convicted of felonies that obviously would not be available to misdemeanors.
But the way the federal law that accepts this reads, the restoration of rights has to specifically exclude gun rights for felons. In other words, right. If the law provides that felons can't possess guns, even though all the other civil rights are restored, then there can be a prosecution under the 922 statute. That's just not going to kick in here because we've got misdemeanants who are not prohibited under state law from possessing guns. So they're in worse shape than felons. Felons can, you know, depending on what state they're in, although most states prohibit felons from possessing guns too. So they're categorically excluded in a typical case.
So they don't have the theoretical ghost of a chance that a felon would have.
Right. I mean, in this situation, it's a perpetual ban.
Well, and perhaps so. But if you look at Mr. Scoyne's history of repeated acts of violence against intimates, I think it's perfectly reasonable. I mean, the court has to decide this based on the whole category of misdemeanors. But if Mr. Scoyne's any indication, it's a reasonable act of Congress.
Well, I guess that level of scrutiny is where I was trying to get to as well. See where you think it should be. But the history of domestic violence is recidivism is a very large element in that, isn't it? That statistics show that those who commit domestic violence have a very high likelihood of committing it again.
That's certainly what Congress found, yes.
That's all I have.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Lieberman, you have 1 minute.
Thank you. And there are really just a couple of points I want to make. And one, to clarify what has been referred to as Mr. Scoyne's history of domestic violence, he has one conviction for domestic violence. Yes, he's had other incidents with his wife and with his previous wife going in both directions. In fact, I would note that his current wife was, as pointed out in the brief, has been convicted of assaulting Mr. Scoyne as well.
By golly, there is justice in the world.
I would also point out that none of his prior convictions have anything to do with use of a gun, threatened use of a gun.
He hasn't gotten to that point yet.
Well, or he's just not the kind of person that ever will, Your Honor.
That possibility exists, of course.
It's also important to note that this ban it doesn't apply to any other misdemeanants. Repeat batterers of anybody other than a spouse. Repeat carriers of concealed weapons in states which make it a misdemeanor are not prohibited under this law from possessing a gun. It only applies to people in Mr. Scoyne's category, and as the court noted, it does put him in a worse position than felons. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope these fine lawyers have committed to taking their sons to lunch now.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks to both counsel.
Oh, I'll bet.
The case is taken under advisement, and you were.